Harper Audio presents Krakatoa, the day the world exploded, the 27th of August, 1883, written and read by Simon Winchester. Prelude. It was early on a warm summer's evening in the 1970s, as I stood in a palm plantation high on a green hillside in western Java, that I saw for the first time, silhouetted against the faint blue hills of faraway Sumatra, the small gathering of islands that is all that remains of what was once a mountain called Krakatoa. There was a high peak to the left of the group, its pyramid shape cut off sharply by its vertical northern cliff. A couple of low islands hugged the horizon to the right. In between them was one small and perfectly formed, absolutely symmetrical low cone, from which rose a thin wisp of smoke. The smoke left a blackish, greyish trail that first rose vertically and then, as it caught the trade winds a few hundred feet above the darkening surface of the sea, was whisked off to the left, melting away until it became no more than a slow-fading stain against the salmon glow of the sunset. I must have stood there, enraptured, until it got quite dark. And then I turned away for the drive back to Jakarta. This, I remembered thinking during the endless night of the long flight back west, had been a scene of an impeccable beauty. And all the more so because it presented a distant prospect of a place where the processes of the world were at work, a place of an elemental significance, and a disastrous place once, but these days quiet again, serenely biding its time. It was almost another quarter of a century before I found myself back in Java. Most of the work I was doing then kept me in the island's centre, in towns like Yogyakarta and Solo and Semarang. But just before I was due to fly away, and because I had a free evening until my plane left, I decided on a whim to make my way back across to the western edge of the island. I drove down to the coast road, just as I had back in the 70s. I wanted to go back for no other reason than to take what I thought would be one final look at a place that, though few beyond the East Indies knew exactly where it was or what it looked like or just what had happened there, had a name, Krakatoa, that had for decades been firmly annealed into the world's collective consciousness. There was a famous film, which admittedly placed the island on the wrong side, the east side of Java. There was a much-loved children's book, which admittedly placed the island in a different ocean, the Pacific, rather than the Indian. The name had become part of the world's cultural lexicon. The word had a vaguely exotic familiarity about it, a certain indefinable resonance. It was a word that people seemed to like, both to say and to have said to them. And now here I was, so close to the volcano once again that the chance of seeing it once more seemed an opportunity that I just shouldn't pass up. When I reached the best viewpoint on the Corniche, it was evening once more, perhaps a little later than before, and so rather darker than when I had last been there. This time the enormous iron lighthouse near the port of Anja, built by the Dutch to replace the one that had been torn away in the terrible waves caused by the great eruption, was sweeping its beam calmly across the unruffled waters of the Sunda Strait, beginning its night on Century Go. The group of islands were there just as before, now black against the vivid deep pinks of the western sky. The giant peak to the left of the group was just as I remembered. The low islands too, this time merging with the evening clouds. And in the middle of them all, its summit seemingly lipped with a curious orange fire, rose the pyramid shape of the one active remnant part of the great disaster. As I looked through my glasses, so I could clearly see that the orange was indeed fire, and that from it rose smoke just as before, only this time a tumble of black billows that towered straight up into the windless late evening sky. But there was one obvious difference. The pyramid, which I now knew to be locally called Anak, which is the Malay word for the child of what had once existed there before the great eruption, seemed this time somehow bigger, sturdier, much taller than I had remembered. I blinked hard, looked again. I measured it as best I could against the big peak to the left, trying to recall where the smaller mountain had stood in relation to that cliff wall. It was higher up now, surely. Yes, there was no doubt. Memory does play tricks in situations like this, to be sure. but as I stared long and hard, I became ever more certain. The volcano, the child of Krakatoa, had grown very much larger during the 25 years that I'd been away. When I got back to the maps, I checked, and I could see in short order that the modern surveys all agreed. The small island mountain, which had been born out of the sea 40-odd years after the very explosion that destroyed and vaporized its parent, was now itself growing fast, thrusting upwards at an extraordinary rate. By looking at the old charts and maps that had been published down the years since the last week of June 1927, when it was first seen above the waves, it was possible to calculate that it had been growing taller, fairly steadily, at an average rate of about 5 inches a week. True, there had been some fits and starts, a lava flow here, a wild eruption there, but generally, Anak Krakatoa had enlarged itself by 20 or so inches each month since 1927. Every year since its birth, it had become higher by 20 feet, and somewhere near 40 feet wider, and if this was indeed so still, I checked my figures once again, then it meant that my mountain was not simply taller, it was fully 500 feet taller than when I'd last seen it. Which is why this sturdy stripling of a volcano has captivated me ever since. It's a volcano that absolutely and very visibly refuses to die. It's a volcano that seems to me to possess that wonderfully seductive combination of being both beautiful and dangerous, unpredictable and unforgettable. And more, though what happened in its former life was unutterably terrible, the realities of geology and seismicity and the peculiar tectonics of Java and Sumatra make sure that what happened back then will without a doubt one day repeat itself in precisely the same way. No one can be sure exactly when. Probably it'll be very many years that is, before anything will befall the world that could possibly be as dreadful as what took place during the historic paroxysmal moment which reached its extraordinary climax at exactly 2:10 on the morning of Monday, the 27th of August, 1883. The explosion itself was terrific, a monstrous thing that still attracts an endless procession of superlatives. It was the greatest detonation, the loudest sound, the most devastating volcanic event in modern recorded human history, and it killed more than 36,000 people. Geological evidence from around the world admits of a number of bigger and more devastating volcanoes, true. Krakatoa is reckoned today to be only the fifth most explosive in the planet's certain geological history. Mounts Toba and Tambora in the East Indies, Taupo in New Zealand and Katmai in Alaska are all thought to have been very much larger, at least in terms of the amount of material they hurled into the sky and the height to which all that material is thought to have soared. But these were all eruptions quite lost to antiquity, with rather little direct effect on human society. When Krakatoa exploded, it was 1883, and the world was a profoundly different place. Sophisticated human beings were on hand to see this volcano's convulsions. They were able to investigate the event, and they were able to attempt to understand the processes that had caused such dreadful violence. And yet, as it happens, their observations, painstaking and precise as science demanded, collided head-on with a most discomforting reality, that while in 1883 the world was becoming ever more scientifically advanced, it was in part because of these same advances that its people found themselves in a strangely febrile and delicately balanced condition, which an event like Krakatoa did much to unsettle. The communications technology of the time, for example, the advances of telegraphy, the building of undersea cables, the flourishing of news agencies, ensured that the world's more advanced peoples learned about the eruption within moments of it happening. But at the same time, the limited and only slowly unfolding geological knowledge then to hand didn't give the audience a sufficient explanation of the events that might soothe their fears about all that they were learning. Hearing of the event quite baffled people thousands of miles away from where it happened, and it left faraway populations bewildered, and in some cases more than a little frightened. Moreover, religious dogma still held a powerful grip on millions, even in societies whose scientific understanding was advancing so rapidly. Tribal ancestors might have explained away an eruption like Krakatoa's. It was simply a matter of the gods being angry. But the luxury of such a facile explanation was not available to the more modern people of 1883, whose growing sophistication meant that they both knew so much about an event like this, and yet at the same time actually knew so little. They had sufficient knowledge of the facts, the news agencies saw to that, but it was a knowledge coupled with an insufficiency of understanding. Many people worried in consequence that the eruption of Krakatoa meant something infinitely more dreadful than it did, that their world was being torn asunder, and perhaps even, as the Bible had foretold, was coming to an end. Fretful and fascinated people around the world, in cities as distant from Java and from each other as Boston and Bombay and Brisbane, all came to know of the event in an instant, and they did so quite simply because this was the world's first major catastrophe to have taken place in the aftermath of the invention of the submarine telegraph. The newspapers were full of it, the descriptions of the happenings made all the more enthralling because they were so perfectly up to date. Words and phrases that had hitherto been utterly unfamiliar, Java, Sumatra, the Sunda Strait, Batavia, became in one mighty flash of eruptive light part of the common currency of all. And in learning of these places and of the terrible events that occurred there, so the world's people became suddenly part of a new brotherhood of knowledge. In a sense, it was that day in August 1883 that the modern phenomenon known as the Global Village was born, in part through the agency of this enormous explosion. The word Krakatoa, despite being a word misspelled and mangled by the imperfect arts of Victorian telegraphy and journalism, became, in one awful, ear-splitting moment, a byname for cataclysm, paroxysm, death and disaster. And the disaster left a trail of practical consequences, political, religious, social, economic, psychological, scientific consequences among them. Even today, curious and chilling echoes of those consequences are still faintly and worryingly discernible, both in Java and around the globe. In all sorts of other observable ways, the impact of Krakatoa on the world's consciousness was profound, and immensely more so than in the case of the eruption of the four technically greater volcanoes of earlier times. Krakatoa had an impact on climate, for example. The airborne debris hurled into the skies lowered the planet's temperature. It changed the appearance of the entire world's skies. It set barometers and tide meters to flailing wildly thousands of miles away. It panicked American firefighters into battling what they thought were raging infernos, but were in truth violent sunsets caused by the roiling clouds of Krakatoan dust. Today, unlike yesterday, and because of all the painstaking and precise work that was begun in the immediate aftermath of the eruption, we know just why it was that Krakatoa erupted, and we now understand only too well the nature of the forces that caused it. An entirely new science has come along to pare away the old and myth-making mysteries of the event and to render this volcano, and indeed all other volcanoes, readily explicable. Nowadays, from a palm plantation high on a green hillside, Krakatoa looks on most days peaceful and serene, with just a thin column of white or grey or on occasion black smoke easing up from the summit. But looks are deceptive. All the while, the Child Mountain is growing steadily and rapidly as the elemental fires that created the world rage deep inside. Chapter 1. An Island with a Pointed Mountain. Though we think first of Java as an eponym for coffee, or to some people today, a computer language, it is in fact the trading of aromatic tropical spices on which the fortunes of the great island's colonisers and Western discoverers were first founded. And initially supreme among those spices was the one rather ordinary variety that remains the most widely used today, pepper. Pippa nigrum, Syzygium aromaticum, and Myristica fragrans, pepper, clove, and nutmeg, were the original holy trinity of the Asian spice trade. Each was familiar to and used by the ancients. 200 years before the birth of Christ, for instance, the Chinese of the Han dynasty demanded that their courtiers address their emperors only when their breath had been sweetened with a mouthful of Javanese cloves, the odoriferous pistils, as they were later more widely known. There is some vague evidence that Roman priests may have employed nutmeg as an incense. It was definitely in use as a flavouring in 9th century Constantinople, since the terrifyingly orthodox St. Theodore the Studite, the scourge of the image-smashing iconoclasts, famously allowed his monks to sprinkle it on the pease pudding they were obliged to eat on days when monastery meat was forbidden. and in Elizabethan times a nutmeg pomander was an essential for keeping foul ailments at bay. The notion that nutmeg could ward off the plague survived longer than many another old wives' tale. Pepper, though, was of infinitely more moment to the ancients than merely to be used as a topping, a nostrum, or a cachou. The Romans used it in abundance. Gibbon wrote of pepper being a favourite ingredient of the most expensive Roman cookery, and added his authority to the widely held idea that Alaric, the rambunctious king of the Visigoths, had demanded more than a ton of it from the Romans as ransom when he laid siege to the city in 410 AD. The aureus and the denarius, the gold and silver currency coins of the empire, became the preferred currency of the spice route, and the Indian pepper merchants of Cochin and Malacca and the ports of southern Ceylon were said to be impressed that the denomination of coins was marked by the number engraved upon them and not their size. However they may have been denominated, an enormous number of them must have been paid out. Pepper was so precious and costly, and so much in demand, that the cost of it all had Pliny the Elder fulminating. There was no year in which India, and by this he meant the Indies, since pepper traded came both from the Malabar coast and from western Java, does not drain the Roman Empire of 50 million sesterces. So dearly, he added dryly, do we pay for our luxury and our women. There is a pleasing symmetry about Pliny's involvement in this part of the story of Krakatoa, even if he appears only in a walk-on role. Although this rich and well-connected former soldier, he was a cavalry officer in Roman Germany, happily took on a variety of official duties on behalf of his emperors, Pliny was above all else a naturalist. He was a savant, or a student, as he once famously put it, of the nature of things, that is, life. His reputation is based largely on his 37-volume Natural History, an immense masterpiece in which, among countless other delights, is the first use of the word from which we derive today's encyclopedia. It was during the late summer of 79 AD, while he was pursuing his official task of investigating piracy in the Bay of Naples, that he was persuaded to explore a peculiar cloud formation that appeared to be coming from the summit of the local mountain Vesuvius. He was duly rowed ashore, visited a local village to calm the panicked inhabitants, and was promptly caught up in a massive eruption. He died of asphyxiation by volcanic gases on the 24th of August, leaving behind him a vast reputation, and as memorial, a single word in the lexicon of modern volcanology, Plinian. A Plinian eruption is now defined as an almighty, catastrophic, explosive eruption that all but destroys the entire volcano from which it emanates. And the most devastating Plinian event of the modern era occurred 1,804 years almost to the day after Pliny the Elder's death at Krakatoa. Pepper has a confused reputation. There's no truth, for example, in the widely held belief that it was once used to hide the taste of putrefying meat. This charming thought perhaps derives from the equally delightful notion, still recognised by druggists today, that pepper can be used as a carminative, a potion that expels entrapped flatulence. But it was very much used as a preservative, and more commonly still, as a seasoning. By the 10th century, it was being imported into England. The Guild of Pepperers, one of the most ancient of the London city guilds, was established at least before 1180, which was when the body was first recorded, as being in court for some minor infraction. By 1328, the guild had been formally registered as an importer of spices in large or gross amounts. Its members were called grossarii, from which comes the modern word grocer. Joseph Conrad caught the obsession in his book Lord Jim. The 17th century traders went there for pepper because the passion for pepper seemed to burn like a flame of love in the breast of Dutch and English adventurers about the time of James I. Where wouldn't they go for pepper? For a bag of pepper they would cut each other's throats without hesitation and would forswear their souls, of which they were so careful otherwise. The bizarre obstinacy of that desire made them defy death in a thousand shapes. The unknown seas, the loathsome and strange diseases, wounds, captivity, hunger, pestilence and despair, it made them great. By heavens, it made them heroic. The Western appetite for the trinity of flavourings increased almost exponentially during the 14th and 15th centuries, the trade being dominated, at least after the papal donation of 1493, by the only serious maritime power of the day in the Orient, the Portuguese. The papal donation, in essence, gave the exploitation of the Western world to Spain and the East to Portugal. The Spaniards, who were seamen and navigators of equal skill, had, under papal supervision, agreed with the Portuguese on the division of the conquerable planet, drawing Pope Julius II's so-called Tordesillas line along the meridian 370 leagues to the west of the Cape Verde Islands, approximately 48 degrees to the west of Greenwich. To the west of this line, Spain had a free hand, hence Mexico, Chile, California. To its east, which crucially included the coast of Brazil, Portugal could freely operate its caravels. And since Africa, Asia, and the islands of the Spice Route lay similarly to the east of the Tordesillas line, so Portugal dominated the exploration of the east and, for a while, the European pepper trade too. The anti-meridian of the Tordesillas line appears in the east too, of course, at around 129 degrees east of Greenwich. Spain colonised the Philippines as a consequence, and Portugal won parts of New Guinea and Timor. The papal donation, which had its origins in a ruling from Pope Alexander VI in 1493, cast a very long shadow indeed. Vasco da Gama, who opened up the east and made it as far as Calicut, was said to be exultant at finding out that the pepper he knew would sell for 80 ducats a hundredweight back in Venice, which was the European centre for the trade, could be bought in India for only 3. A steady stream of Portuguese merchantmen and explorers promptly left the Tagus for the Orient, one of them, Pedro Alvarez Cabral, discovering and then claiming Brazil on the way. And for a while the Portuguese entirely dominated the business. The ancient overland route, ships to Arabia, camels to the Mediterranean, was utterly changed. Now it was massive sailing ships all the way, via West Africa and the Cape, and in just the same way as Roman currency became the common coin of the old route, so the Portuguese language became the lingua franca of the new. But slowly, time and technology intervened. By the 16th century, the Dutch and the English, now with all the skills for shipbuilding finely tuned, with all the oak they needed for their hulls and all the flax they wanted for their sails and all the cannonry their foundries could produce and the navigating wherewithal for making long journeys fast and safely, found that they could outrun and outgun all the fine vessels from Lisbon. More than a few Dutch ships, flagged with the Portuguese bandera to get around the royal prohibitions on non-Iberians trading in the Orient, were now coming home and whetting the appetites of the Amsterdam merchants for pepper and for profit. And so slowly, under the force of these various imperatives, the balance of maritime power in the East started to change. The Portuguese from the warm and lazy south were slowly driven out and replaced by doughty Europeans from the cold and rather more ruthless north. The change began somewhat inauspiciously in late June of 1596, when a ragged flotilla of 4 Dutch vessels dropped anchor in the roads off the northwestern Javanese pepper port of Banten and invited the Portuguese spice merchants, whose godowns had long lined the shore, to come aboard. The voyage had been sponsored by the 9 merchant adventurers of the Compagnie van Veer of Amsterdam, in translation simply the Long Distance Company, who had been inspired by the idea of blazing a spice trade route to the Indies. It had not gone at all well. Cornelius de Houtman, who commanded the venture, turned out to be both an inept navigator and a cantankerous martinet. Not that he had been wanting a preparation. Along with his brother Frederick, he had already spent 2 years in Lisbon gathering intelligence on the Portuguese operations in the East. His expedition was grandly titled Eerste Scheepvaart, the first ship sailing. It excited much attention as, with 249 men aboard, it swept out into the Zuider Zee, and after provisioning at the merchant docks inshore of Texel, fell away from the roads on the morning of the 2nd of April, 1595. It ran promptly into a whole sea of troubles. The provisioning had been too hasty. After a matter of only a few weeks, scurvy had broken out, with sailors suffering such rending stomach pains among their other symptoms that the Dutch still have a word for it, skurbuik, tearing belly. Disputes raged between the onboard merchants and the ship's masters. One merchant was locked in his cabin in chains for the entire voyage, another was poisoned in India, a master fell victim to a mutiny. De Houtman proved himself to be no more than a boaster and a ruffian. A short stopover in Madagascar for the convoy to catch its breath turned into a six-month death watch, during which so many crew members died that there's still a Madagascan bay called the Dutch Cemetery. By the time the venture reached Banten, only 100 Dutchmen were still alive. The surprised Portuguese at first made them welcome, probably assuming that so wretched a gaggle of starving men could hardly pose much of a challenge to the might of Lisbon. The head of the Entrepot sent a message to his immediate superior in Goa, on the Indian coast, though more for reasons of diplomatic propriety than disquiet. He then introduced the visitors to the local Banten Sultan, who was sufficiently impressed with them to enter into a treaty, the first formal document between Dutchmen and Javanese of what would prove to be a 3.5 centuries long relationship of repression, exploitation, and too often most cruel colonisation. "We are well content," the Sultan wrote, "to have a permanent league of alliance and friendship with His Highness the Prince and with you, gentlemen." The contentedness would not long survive. Some indication of what would evolve into a deeply unhappy relationship between the Dutch and their soon-to-be subject people came good and early during the subsequent sojourn of the De Houtman expedition. Much of Sumatra and Java had already become widely Islamicized. The earliest known Muslim grave on Java dates from 1419, after which the creed took hold rapidly, and the local people and their leaders were acutely sensitive to the strange ways of the European infidels. The Portuguese had seemingly shown a measure of tact. The Dutch, on the other hand, had a reputation for being crass and insensitive in their dealings with the primitives that they met. Cornelis de Houtman himself insulted the Banten Sultan. Contemporary accounts are not specific and speak only of de Houtman's rude behaviour, and was ordered to leave port. De Houtman's flotilla sailed east, was then attacked by pirates off Surabaya. A dozen more of his crew were killed, and one of his ships had to be abandoned and set ablaze because there were too few hands to work it. In retribution for the piracy, he ordered a brief campaign of systematic rape and pillage off the coast of Madura, but had calmed by the time he reached Bali, as many others find themselves similarly soothed. He found that the king of Bali was a good-natured fat man who had 200 wives, drove a chariot pulled by 2 white buffaloes, and owned 50 dwarves. He was, perhaps understandably, given his location, not the best informed of monarchs, when de Houtman, keen to impress him with Holland's importance, drew him a map of Europe showing the Dutch borders lying improbably close to Venice and Moscow. The old man did not for a moment even raise a sceptical eyebrow. The crew liked the place hugely. One further sailor deserted. But there were yet more rows, and before they left, an ill-tempered de Houtman had to be almost forced to accept a cargo of a few pots of peppercorns, which the expedition took back to Amsterdam. Their return voyage by way of Java's south coast was every bit as miserable and almost as time-consuming as the outbound, and 7 more sailors dropped dead almost as soon as they reached home, their stomachs reacting violently to the change back to civilised rations. But for all the blundering tragedy of that first Dutch expedition, the achievement could hardly be gainsaid, for it did bring back those few pots of precious black Java pepper. And that, it seemed to the 9 sponsoring merchants of Amsterdam, was all that really counted. The Portuguese stranglehold on Oriental spice trading could now, in theory, at long last be broken. Other, better-furnished expeditions could probably now venture out and obtain more pepper and cloves and nutmeg and its attendant aral called mace, as well as the cinnamon which grew close by, and thus help make the mercantile barons of Holland richer than could be imagined. One might have expected a spirited reaction from the Portuguese. They did indeed react, but then they managed to blunder even more calamitously than had the Dutch. The Portuguese ran their Estado da India from Goa on the western coast of India. Their viceroy there had received from his agents the news of the de Houtman expedition and promptly decided that he would see to it that no such impertinence happened again. He dispatched a specially built fleet south to Banten, but the admiral he chose for the mission, a still infamous in Lisbon figure named Don Lorenzo de Brito, took such a long time to get there that the Dutch whom he had planned to confront had already upped and sailed back to, and at the time were in fact comfortably ensconced in, Amsterdam. So the admiral, apoplectic, turned his fury on the Bantanese, despite his chief in Goa having ordered him specifically to do no such thing. He tried to teach them a lesson for having dared be hospitable to his master's rivals, and was promptly outfoxed by the Javanese sailors' battling techniques. He lost 2 of his 4 ships and withdrew, humbled, to Malacca to lick his wounds. Though neither he, nor his viceroy, nor King Philip back home recognised the import of the moment, the skirmish between the Bantanese and the tiny fleet from Goa marked the beginning of the end for Portugal's imperial role in the East. It took a while for it to be wholly extinguished. The reversion of Macau from Portuguese to Chinese rule in 1999 marked the final drawing down of blinds, but the lights began to go out from that moment. "Look at the Portuguese," noted the British ambassador to India, Sir Thomas Rowe. "In spite of all their fine settlements, they are beggared by the maintenance of military forces, and even their garrisons are only mediocre." Within half a century, only Goa, Macau, Mombasa, the ports of Mozambique, and in the Indies, Flores and Timor remained. The power of the old Iberian empires was suddenly waning. Entirely new trading empires, directed by men from the chilly North European capitals of Amsterdam and London, were about to be born. From the moment of the return of that first unhappy excursion to Java and beyond, shoals of Dutch fleets, each one backed by packs of excited adventurers, began coursing across the ocean, bound for Banten and the fast-opening Oriental universe beyond. In May 1598, a fleet twice the size of de Houtman's and under the command of the more competent and distinguished sea captain Jacob van Neck left Texel for Banten, reached there in half the time, and sailed away with enough pepper for its backers to realise no less than a 400% return on their investment. The floodgates then opened once and for all. Before the end of 1601, 14 fleets had gone east, a total of 65 vessels. Most had passed along the conventional route via the Cape of Good Hope. Others, keen to get first to the spice-rich islands on the eastern side of the archipelago, took the much riskier path southwestwards across the open Atlantic, through the newly discovered but windy and reef-strewn Strait of Magellan, and then across the entire Pacific Ocean. It was an extraordinary, boisterous, devil-may-care time, and the docks in Hoorn and Enkhuizen and Amsterdam were frantic with shipping, always leaving, leaving, leaving. Some of the more sober-sided Hollanders sniffed over their glasses of Geneva and accused the adventurers of indulging what they termed the wild navigation. And wild it may well have been, but the commercial results were obvious. The Hollanders were onto something big. Banten itself, though it was once the largest city in Southeast Asia and one of the most famous of the world's 17th-century ports, is these days anything but big. The garrison, which the local sultan permitted the Dutch to build, Fort Spielwijk, still stands. With its 10-foot-thick walls, its worn machicolations and breastworks, its muddy tunnels and embrasures now greasy with tropic mould, it's a melancholy reminder of how mighty and ambitious the Dutch once had been. The sea, which their vigilant sentries once scanned for approaching enemy sails, laps now a full mile away beyond the fort's curtain walls. Silt, oozing from the river, started to choke the estuary in the 19th century, and before long had rendered Banten Port unusable for vessels much larger than whalers and large canoes. Its rise was spectacular, its fall, like the fall of empires more generally, slow and inevitable. It's long since been abandoned as a port. Nowadays Banten is little more than a collection of shanties and ruins, with a lane of shops selling Muslim caps and boxes of locally grown dates. There are no local pepper plantations. Western Java has turned its plantations to tapioca and coffee, and it is Sumatra that now produces about a sixth of the world's 200,000 yearly tons of Piper nigrum. Yet Banten still makes its own contribution to the economic well-being of the islands. Just beside the old Dutch fort, at the entrance to the maze of lanes that lead to the former sultan's ruined palace, stands a curious trio of immense and very ugly cement towers. They look mysterious and rather sinister. They're formidably well guarded with razor wire, attack dogs and civilian guards, one of them a young woman who contentedly suckled her infant when I inquired, in vain, if I might go inside. They look as if they might be kin to Fort Spielwijk, fortresses of a kind too, a protection for a population fretful about some nameless and more contemporary disaster. In fact, they're nothing of the kind. The towers are man-made homes for the local birds called swiftlets, members of the genus Colocalia, whose saliva is the basis for that most celebrated Cantonese aphrodisiac, bird's nest soup. The tower's owner is a Chinese restaurateur from Jakarta. He thinks it most unlikely that any client would ever realise that the soup he serves comes not from nests plucked in the traditional manner from dangerous clifftops in Thailand, but from nests farmed weekly inside a cement blockhouse in a former Dutch pepper port. He's reputed to be one of the wealthiest Chinese in all of modern Java. He was blissfully unaware that he had made his fortune in the town that had once made other outsiders, the entirely dissimilar burghers of 17th-century Amsterdam, extremely wealthy too. With the advent of those Dutch, whose maritime traditions had already spawned prodigious legions of cartographers, came maps. Good, beautiful, accurate, and before too long, utterly magnificent maps. With the making of maps came the observed and calculated details of place. And with details of place came names. And among them, and quite early in the process, the first naming of the tiny island that is the subject of this story. For 1,500 years, the notion of the great Greek astronomer Ptolemy, and published in his definitive Geography, was that Africa and Asia were one, connected by a land bridge across the southern Indian Ocean. It took a very long while to discredit this idea. But by the 14th century, and based on reports from early explorers such as Marco Polo, and intelligence gathered from Arab travellers and traders, cartographers in Europe began to suppose the existence of a number of peninsulas and discrete islands littering the ocean between China and Africa. The dangling appendages of India and the Malayan Peninsula began to appear on maps first, and then three of the largest supposed islands, today's Borneo, Sumatra and Java, started to be depicted on charts printed in the 16th century, though there was a long period when lozenge-shaped Sumatra was confused with its not-too-distant neighbour, pearl-drop-shaped Ceylon. Martin Beheim's Globe of 1492, his Erdapfel, or Earthapple, as this solid wooden sphere was charmingly called, shows painted on its surface the islands of Java and Sumatra, part of a ragged chain of land between a quite distinct Malayan peninsula and a body of vaguely determinate shape that is just recognisable as Borneo. And Martin Waldseemüller, the German mapmaker who, in 1507, was the first to put the name America onto a world map, clearly indicates on one of the same woodcut's dozen sheets an island to which he gives the name Java Minor, quite separate from another island to its west. And even before these, there were prescient maps made elsewhere. Early Thai, Indian and Korean maps, often delightfully fanciful, indicate bodies of land that could well be the two huge islands. There's also a copy of a 4th century Roman road map from England to India, with the distances variously measured out in Roman miles, Gallic leagues and Persian parasangs, showing Ceylon as a decidedly insular Taprobane at its bottom right-hand corner, but which, from its size and familiar shape, could easily be confused for Sumatra. Once the Italian, Spanish and Portuguese sailor adventurers began to penetrate to the east of Malacca, however, this imprecision vanished. Sumatra and Java are by then named and shown to exist most assuredly, separated by a body of water called the Strait of Sunda. Far to their east, the nutmeg island of Banda finds its way onto a map of 1516, as well as a proper, and more or less properly spelled, Borneo, located 5 years before Magellan's expeditions reached it on history's first, and for Magellan tragic and fatal, circumnavigation. The Moluccas, Timor, the Celebes and the Philippines likewise all begin to appear on maps and portolanos and charts as well, their positions and their dimensions depicted ever more accurately, such that by the end of the 16th century, when the Dutch were poised to sail in from Texel and try to wrest the spice monopoly from the stranglehold of the Mediterranean powers, every major island between the Maldives and the coast of China was illustrated, reasonably correct in outline, place and size. And then, with the turn of the century, and as those first commercial fleets began their laborious voyages out from the Zuider Zee, so, along with the merchants, went the Dutch cartographic masters. These were men possessed of formidable naval knowledge, great artistic brilliance, and still unrivalled map-making skills, who would both push back the boundaries of world cartographic knowledge further and ever further, and add to their new developed picture of the planet a wonderful measure of beauty and style. Their maps are treasures, awesome in both utility and aspect. And it was one of these mapmakers, Jan Huygen van Linschoten, who was to make the first positive identification of the volcano island that would make such mischief in the years ahead. Van Linschoten was a curious and energetic traveller, a man afflicted by wanderlust centuries before the ailment was properly known. "My heart is longing day and night for voyages to faraway lands," his journals note in an entry for 1587. His travels were prodigious. He was keenly interested in the Arctic, and his numerous journeys there, to the lonely supra-Russian island of Novaya Zemlya, for example, to which he went with the Dutchman who named the Barents Sea, were recounted in a hugely popular book that inspired both the English and the Dutch to try to forge a sea route through the ice to India. They never did. But it was for the maps he created as a byproduct of his 6 years in service to the Portuguese that he remains best known today. He had travelled east via Africa and the Cape across to the administrative capital of Goa in western India, working as a bookkeeper to the Portuguese Catholic Archbishop. He spent the 6 years from 1583 in the immense province, travelling with the divine, noting furiously every detail of every place and peoples he visited, though we don't know if he actually visited Java and the islands to its east. In 1595 he published his account of it all, Itinerario, one of the most detailed travel guides ever known. And bound into the volume were a number of remarkable maps, some by Portuguese mapmakers, some by Spaniards, and one exquisite map of the Far East drawn by Van Linschoten himself. The map itself has a curious history. It was executed by a Dutchman, based on information that Van Linschoten admits was from the most correct charts that the Portuguese pilots nowadays make use of, and later handed over and republished for the English. The custom was for these four powers jealously to guard such information, yet in the case of this one beautiful creation, with great cartouches, sea monsters, rum lines, the arms of Portugal and a flourish of compass roses, it was allowed to be seen by the navigating hierarchs of all four competing nations. On the map, much is recognisable. China, the Mekong, Malaya, Luzon. The islands of Java and Sumatra are also named and shaped more or less as they should be, although the island of Sulawesi nearby is a strange paramecium shape, according to one critic. Between Sumatra and what Linschoten calls Java Major is a narrow strait, and within it a tangled mess of unnamed islands. But though they are anonymous, there is, and crucially for this story, the text from the Itinerario, which acts as a vade mecum for any Java-bound navigators using the map, and whom it duly advises to reach the mouth of the Sunda Strait, stay close to the mainland of Sumatra, always keeping a good eye out for the mountains and cliffs, of which there are many ahead, for one does not know where one will find the mouth of the strait, except only by the knowledge of the islands. Look for a high island located straight across from the land tip on the north side of Sumatra, which, with the island of Java Major, forms the strait that ends here. On the northwest side of the coast are two or three small islands about 1 mile away from land. On the island closest to land, a Frenchman was run aground once. Its guns went to the king of the island Bantam, and the one from Calapa. And a mile from land towards the south is an island with a high top or pointed mountain. There can be no doubt at all, despite Van Linschoten neither naming this island on his chart nor in Itinerario, that this is Krakatoa. He probably never saw it. Though he travelled widely from Goa, there's no certainty that he visited the archipelago itself. All his reports come from his immense network of Portuguese pilots. But there simply is no other island in the strait that fits his description, or rather, until 1883, there was no other such island in the strait. Since that August morning, the original island has essentially not existed at all. There is just no pointed mountain in either Van Linschoten's reported position at the northern end of the strait, nor, for that matter, anywhere else nearby. Others of those early Dutch cartographers are revered along with Van Linschoten. Blau, Lodewijks, Hondius, Visscher, and equally important in this one context, Lucas Janszoon Wegener. For though Van Lincherton writes briefly of his island with its pointed summit in 1595, and though a year later Willem Lodewijks records so many small islands in the strait that one crew said they had difficulty finding a channel along its western side, it was the Wagoneer map that first depicted the island and properly captioned it with an approximation of the soon-to-be-familiar name. Lucas Janszoon Wagoneer was a Dutch pilot who almost single-handedly revolutionised the entire business of seaborne maps. For until his publication in 1583 of A Rutter, a mass-produced collection of navigational notes and charts which a mariner might use to help plan a voyage in unfamiliar waters, such maps as a ship's captain had taken on board were handmade, singly produced and often ultra-secret. Wagoneer decided instead that ships' charts should be printed using wooden or engraved metal blocks. They should be made by the hundreds, the better to encourage men to sail, to explore and to discover. His maps are many and are among the finest ever made. They are colourful, filled like Lincherton's with elaborate cartouches, ships in full sail, fabulous sea monsters and a host of devices, compasses, scales, indications of deeps and shallows, which are still in use on charts today. His name was anglicised to Wagoneer, and so popular and respected did his works become that the word is still heard in some of the older chandleries and still appears in dictionaries of the sea, Dalrymple's famous chart book once being known colloquially as the English Wagoneer. His exquisite chart of the Sunda Strait was published in 1602, 7 years after the Itinerario. Engraved on the map, halfway between the immense body of land called Suma Pars and its equally immense eastern neighbour, Javai Pars, is a group of what appears to be four small islands, a trinity of larger bodies partially enclosing a fourth. The inscription says simply, Pulo Kakata. It was half a century before the island was named in a prose work. In October 1658, a Dutch doctor, Wouter Schoten, noted in his travelogue having passed the high tree-covered island Krakatau, the first mention of the island by its currently accepted name. As to the origin of the name, it sometimes seems that there are almost as many theories as there are geographers. The word Pulau that appears on the Wagoneer chart remains, since it's the modern Bahasa Indonesian word for island, but Kakata or Krakatau or something in between, both the idea of what should be the spelling and the etymologies of whatever names have been and are now generally chosen for the island, are an enduring mystery. There was an early and linguistically alluring report by a French Jesuit priest, Guy Tachard, suggesting it is an onomatopoeia. Tachard passed the island 80 years after the Dutch cartographers had, and wrote in his log to the effect that we made many tacks to double the island of Kakatua, so called because of the white parrots that are upon that isle and which incessantly repeat the name. It sounds improbable, not least because of the difficulty that any mariner might experience trying to hear the call of land-based birds from high on the windy deck of a passing ship. Others subsequently thought that Krakatoa, or the more common local form Krakatau, derives essentially from either of three words, kata-kakata, kakataka, or rakata, which are the Sanskrit and, according to some old Javan words, meaning lobster or crab. Then there's a Malay word, kelakatoe, which means flying white ant. Since crabs and parrots belong on the island, or since they did at least until that dire August morning in 1883, any one of the last two lexical explanations seems reasonably acceptable. White ants, though, only occur in the eastern part of the entire archipelago, rendering this theory rather less than credible, though perhaps rather more credible than the notion, briefly popular in Batavia, that an Indian ship's captain had asked a local boatman what name was given to the pointed mountain he could see, prompting the local to reply, Kagatau, meaning, I don't know. The effect of the eastward onrush of armadas of Dutch sailing vessels, their captains now well equipped with their bound collections, their rutters of the region's new printed charts, was immediate and profound. Such Portuguese as remained were soon overwhelmed and dismissed. They were eventually and officially sent packing from the Banten pepper port in 1601. In 1605, the Dutch had seized all the eastern islands of the Moluccas, and which included the Nutmeg and Clove Islands of the Banda Sea. The fort at Solor fell in 1613, and Malacca, the great trading station on the western side of the Malay Peninsula, passed from the control of Goa to that of Amsterdam in 1641. The Dutch speedily assumed power across fully 45 degrees of eastern longitude, and before long, effective control of what was to be called the East Indies was almost, aside from tenacious Portuguese holdouts on the islands of Flores and Timor, and fast-fading competition from the British in a variety of tempting places, entirely theirs. In 1602, the Dutch took a step of profound importance. It was a move that, as well as hugely improving their own merchants' fortunes in the East, helped to create a business model for the foundations of all of modern capitalism. The government formally chartered a company, the Vereenigde Oost-Indische Compagnie, known to this day as the VOC, to act in cooperative concert and as a monopoly in all trading matters to the east of the Cape of Good Hope. And not just trading, the VOC was given exclusive and quasi-sovereign rights to enter into treaties with local princes, to build forts, to maintain armed forces, and to set up administrative systems of governments whose officials pledged loyalty to the government of the Netherlands. The idea of officially sanctioned trading cooperatives was far from new. The British had had the merchant adventurers and the merchant staplers. They had created the Muscovy Company in 1555 and the Turkey Company in 1583. Plymouth Company and the Massachusetts Bay Company were established at the beginning of the 17th century to settle colonists. The Hudson's Bay Company, set up half a century later solely to trade, remains today. The Bay, its flagship department store, can be found in all of Canada's modern cities and in not a few more isolated Arctic settlements, and its owner, a cheerfully eccentric peer called Ken Thompson, lives modestly and happily in a suburb of Toronto. But there was a difference about the VOC. Right from its beginnings, it was cleverly constructed as a joint stock company. The good burghers of Holland, who had initially sent out their own small fleets, decided to band together to back a much larger, much more ambitious company, with each backer owning a share of this company's value, with the value of each share depending on the amount by which each shareholder backed it. This new concept of a joint stock company, with in this case a start-up capital of 6.5 million guilders, was to become the model for all the thousands upon thousands of publicly traded firms that are listed on the world's bourses and stock exchanges today, and whose raison d'etre, the sharing of risk and the sharing of reward, lies now at the beating heart of the modern capitalist system. The Gentlemen 17, as were called the directors of the VOC, may have been ultimately responsible to the Dutch Parliament, but they were also financially responsible to those who bought shares in the company, to the merchants and the bankers who had taken the bold and revolutionary view that such a costly undertaking, impossibly expensive for any one Dutch company to afford, might in time win vast profits for them if they supported it collectively and backed it in concert. The VOC may be best known to historians for having ruled most of the East Indies for two centuries, from 1602 until its collapse in a welter of ignominy and corruption in 1799, but students of finance know it best for its seminal effect on the making of the model for an institution that underpins much of the prosperous West's current way of economic life. The first steps were modest enough. A renewal of the Pepper Treaty with the Sultan of Banten, the takeover of spice factories on the Banda Islands, in Aceh in central Sumatra, and at a number of small ports on the Malay Peninsula, the rebuilding of a conquered Portuguese fort in Ambon in the Spice Islands that was to become the first permanent Dutch military base in the region and which would protect, from the newly predatory English mainly, their fleets that were now carrying cinnamon, cloves and nutmeg home in enormous tonnages. Before long, however, it became evident to the stockholders back in the Netherlands that there might be much more money to be made if at least some of the ships stationed out east began actually to trade within the East, taking goods not just from Java to Holland, but from Java to Sumatra, say, or from Gaul in Ceylon to Macassar in the Celebes. The local people weren't fully exploiting their potential for trading, so why didn't the Dutch, who had the ships and the growing navigational knowledge, confidence and skill, trade for themselves? And so the practice known as country trading began, with skippers from faraway Holland sailing along the immense coastlines of an archipelago that is now known to embrace more than 17,000 islands, bringing cargoes from merchant to merchant and carrying not a small tonnage of their own goods, by the sale of which some became extremely wealthy men. Just one warning was sounded during those early, braggartly optimistic days. It was a warning that would sound intermittently through all the succeeding years of Dutch rule in the East, that would find echoes in the rule of other European powers beyond Europe, that would extend past and become surprisingly important locally immediately after the explosion of Krakatoa, and that would reverberate across the world with varying intensity and degree right through to modern times. And this toxin note was the suspicious and on occasion the openly hostile relationship that occasionally developed between the Dutch and those local people who were, and already for the past two centuries had been, as the papers of the day called them, Mohammedans. From the very moment the Dutch admirals met with the sultans of Ambon and Banda, the easy-going arrogance of the visiting Christian Dutch sat uneasily with the rigid formalisms of Islamic belief. An entire spectrum of antipathy developed. Almost from the beginning there was suspicion, disdain and contempt felt and expressed on both sides. Relations between Muslim and Christian, in the East Indies and throughout the Eastern world, presents a discordant continuo in the telling of the tale of Krakatoa. Surviving portraits usually show Jan Pieterszoon Coen, hatless and crop-headed, with a menacingly thin moustache and goatee, and invariably dressed in the frills and furbelows of the time, a soft lace millstone ruff, black and heavily embroidered doublet, an elaborate system of belts and buckles holding up a silver-handled Toledo sword. He never smiles or looks in any way genial. To those who painted him, he seemed always stern, forbidding, ruthless. Whether he did indeed look that way, or whether the portraitist simply reflected the abiding perception of the man, we cannot know. But everyone in the Netherlands and in the East seemed to know only too well that Coen, the founding father of the Dutch Empire in the Orient, was not, by any stretch of the imagination, a kindly man. No doubt his Calvinist roots, he was born in the small, religious and conservative fishing town of Hoorn on the Zuider Zee, had much to do with his attitude. The fact that he witnessed an early slaughter of Dutchmen at the hands of Spice Islanders, the admiral in command of his first voyage to the East and 50 of his men were killed in the Banda group in a massacre that Coen long vowed he would avenge, was maybe of even more influence. Whatever the roots of his disdain, by the time the Gentleman 17 saw fit in 1618 to promote him as the fourth and most famous of their governors general of the East Indies, Coen was a man in a mood only to go out east to enforce, expand, discipline and punish, and to lay the foundations for what would in due course become a world-class trading empire, and an empire which would have at its epicentre, as Rome and Athens and Venice had in their turn been before, a world-class capital city. The directors back in Amsterdam had recognised early on the need for a regional headquarters, a place from where they might administer their Indies, somewhere where they might victual and water and rest their imperial adventurers, somewhere where they might repair their warships or build new trading sloops, somewhere from where they might pause to reflect on the vast territory they were fast acquiring and learn about its subtleties and plan its future course. The existing major centres, Malacca and Banten, had problems, Malacca still being run by the Portuguese and Banten ruled by a sultan whose congeniality was capricious, to say the least. The only site that tempted Coen when he became governor-general in 1618 was the tiny fort that the Banten sultan had allowed the Dutch to build on the right bank of a greasy and slow-flowing river called the Chiliwung on Java's north coast, opposite a village called Jayakarta. The only obvious disadvantage was the local presence of a fair number of British adventurers and would-be colonisers. Ever since Sir Francis Drake, on his great circumnavigation, had arrived in the Moluccas in 1579, there had been a British presence, and men like Sir Thomas Cavendish and James Lancaster had enjoyed some success with the local chiefs, presenting themselves as potential enemies of the Portuguese. The British colonial intentions for Java and Sumatra were formless and they lacked direction, but British engineers had built a fort on the left bank of the Chiliwung River, beside Jayakarta, at least to protect their traders. Coen, aware of their potential rivalry and sure that they meant in time to become a local imperial power, decided to toss them out. It looked likely to be a tougher task than he at first supposed. The British Army garrison was larger than his, and the Royal Navy squadron had 14 vessels, while Cohen had only 8. He wrote beseechingly to the directors in Amsterdam, asking for reinforcements. His request was ignored. He promptly left town in high dudgeon. "I swear to you that the company has no enemies who more hinder and harm it here than the ignorance and thoughtlessness which reigns among your excellencies and defies understanding." And he sailed off to the Dutch fort in Ambon, hoping that he might find reinforcements there. By doing so, he missed such action as then took place, which wasn't much, and most of which descended rapidly into farce. The British laid half-hearted siege to the tiny Dutch fort, irritating the Dutch storekeeper, a Mr. Van den Broek, by forcing him to build barricades out of the very costly bolts of silk and batik cloth he had waiting for export. Then a row broke out between the Britons and the local junior sultan over how the spoils of the coming fight, if won, would be divided. Next, the Sultan of Banten brought in his fleet to make sure that neither the British nor the junior local prince should benefit from Dutch weakness. And the upshot of all this noise and tumult was the opening of four-way negotiations, the sudden abandonment of the scene by the British, and the overthrow by the Banten Sultan of the junior local prince. All of a sudden, by dint less of savage and courageous fighting than of unseemly argument among their many foes, the Dutch found that they had won. Their fort was unscathed and secure. Mr. Den Broek could take down his precious bolts and bales and send them back to the godown. And when Jan Pieterszoon Cohen returned home from the Moluccas, shipless and much delayed, but that's quite another story, he found to his surprise, and considering he was such a bellicose man always spoiling for a fight, some small dismay, that his men and his little fortress were all safe and sound. He also discovered that in a moment of relief, celebration and sentimental rapture, the men he had left behind him had, on the 12th of March 1619, realised they were now free to transform their fortress into their planned regional headquarters, and so they had given their tiny settlement what they considered a properly dignified Dutch name, Batavia. Jan Pieterszoon Cohen, the founder of the Dutch East Indies, can take credit for much, but the naming of the capital that he founded is an honour that belongs to an unsung and quite forgotten soldier, and decidedly not to him. And yet, to whomever the glory of foundation belongs, the coming role of this city is undeniable. A great Oriental conurbation was soon to be in the making here, a headquarters for a gathering of Europeans that would all be key to the engine work of a great colonial capital. There would soon be small armies of Dutchmen working in Batavia as merchants, traders, bankers, surveyors, soldiers, farmers, engineers, tax collectors, teachers, accountants, spies, philosophers, historians and scientists, and a whole host more of professions and trades. It was the particular concentration in the city of the scientists, however, that is most important to this story, for there would soon be men and institutes and laboratories dotted around Jan Pieterszoon Cohen's great capital, specifically charged with keeping under close scrutiny the East's manifest natural peculiarities, peculiarities which included on more than one occasion the spectacularly unpredictable nature of her geology, especially that readying itself to erupt so terrifyingly in the narrow body of water that lay quietly off to the west and less than 100 miles away. Chapter 2. The Crocodile in the Canal. The name Batavia has a kind of easy, silky poetry to it. The Dutch, who were exceptionally proud of having created their great administrative supercity for the Orient from scratch, a somewhat less than entirely accurate claim, as the equally proud Javanese are still eager to point out, like to think of it as their Queen of the East. The choice of the name was a nicely sentimental notion. Batavia was the old name for Holland, later the Netherlands more generally, the Batawi having been a tribe first recognised by the Romans, who inhabited a muddily fertile peninsula between the Rhine and the Waal, some few miles south of what is now the city of Utrecht. There had in fact been a village beside the muddy seepings of the Chiliwung River long before the men of the VOC had planted their corporate flag with its distinctive logo, one of the world's first ever, used on colonial coins and public buildings too, beside their silk and spices warehouses. What would be known as Batavia, until the Dutch were compelled to leave it in 1949, had hitherto been known by its more appropriately Javanese name, Jayakarta, which meant victorious and prosperous. In 1949, as capital of the newly independent Indonesia, the city reverted to what its new leaders thought as its happily suitable old name, though they modernised it a little to today's Jakarta. There are many, and not simply elderly Dutchmen of nostalgic temperament, who still think Batavia a sweeter sound. And generally speaking, old Batavia was, outwardly at least, and for much of its history, a very much sweeter place than now. Today, more than 17 million people cluster around the Chiliwung's long-cemented and mostly vanished riverbanks, clambering and jostling and polluting in the kind of cheerful hugga-mugga mayhem that marks many a modern Asian city. Jakarta is not at all a pretty place, and for a visitor stuck stickily in an interminable traffic jam between gaudy hotels, gimcrack office blocks and tar-paper shanties, it's difficult to imagine it ever enjoying a queenly status or ever having been a favoured place for posting or employment. But though Batavia has had more than her share of urban wretchedness, there was a golden era, most especially so around the time that Krakatoa exploded, when it was very much a queen among cities, and a place for which many felt great fondness. Less so, however, during those formative early company years when the VOC was feeling its way into the East. The first settlers were, by and large, rather frightened men, understandably bewildered by the environment they found themselves in, and not at all sure whether they were in Batavia to lay the foundations of a great city, or simply to build a hasty confection of a town that could serve as company headquarters while somewhere more congenial was waiting to be found. They did their best, however, to turn the sultry and fetid estuary that Jan Pieterszoon Coen had chosen as his base into somewhere that might remind them, at least a little, of their home. They built their fortress, a prison, an armoury, a treasury, a Protestant church and a modest palace for their governor-general on a sandspit out in the roads. With quiet and deliberate speed, however, all of this complex became landlocked as more and more of the lagoon was dredged, more and more real estate was reclaimed, and more houses thrown up around it. A network of narrow streets, Amsterdamstraat, Utrechtstraat, and 16 canals, the evocatively named De Luinengracht, Bakkerachtsgracht, and Stadsbinnengracht, among them, were then built in the jungle. The canals, in particular, lined with flowering tamarind trees, were also intended to remind the settlers of home. But in fact, since local crocodiles got into the disagreeable habit of sauntering carelessly along them and poking their noses into the residents' doorways, the gesture had for a while rather the opposite effect. Across the Chiliwung River, which was straightened and given high earthen embankments, an engineer constructed a classic Dutch drawbridge, the kind of double-sided bridge with struts and wires and T-shaped wooden beams that is still found spanning the canals in Amsterdam today, but of which the most famous is actually at Arles in southern France, because a homesick Vincent van Gogh had painted the specimen there. The very first Batavia bridge still exists. It's called Hoorn der Passerbrug, the Chicken Market Bridge, and is one of the more powerful reminders of only a very few that have survived that the Dutch ever did hold sway over this bustling modern city. In some evening lights, and if one can forget the sight and sound of the choking traffic, there is a touch of Rembrandt to the scene, a hint of Van Gogh among the diesel fumes. Because the early Dutch were petrified of attacks from the Javanese, from the often hostile Sultan of Banten nearby and his opposite number at Mataram in the island's centre, so they also built themselves a wall. They did so at least in part because there was a particular fear abroad, especially among some of those Dutchmen who knew a little of the ways of India and Malaya and Arabia, that they were at risk of being murdered in their beds by fanatical Muslims. But as it turned out, the Dutch in Java had precious little cause to be so apprehensive. The Javanese sultans were indeed Muslims, as were their followers, and if Islamic orthodoxy was being strictly obeyed, then they were men who were perhaps in theory likely to be ill-disposed towards the pale-skinned infidel invaders. But here, the theory simply didn't apply. In the 17th and 18th centuries, at the very time the Dutch were arriving and setting up colonial camp, the old orthodoxies of Islam were hardly being obeyed at all. The faraway mullahs of Araby were just not being heeded, and nor were their teachings. A homegrown, locally brewed version of the creed was proving immensely more popular. The Islam that had swept so furiously through Sumatra and Java in the 15th century had evolved, rather swiftly, into a gentler amalgam of beliefs and passions, had become very different from the rigorous pursuits of the desert-dried Arabs. Here, in Java in particular, on an island of lush and fecund tropics, a place where there was colour and gaiety and a tradition of vibrant animist religions and curious and long-revered local gods, and where sex was fun and girls went half-naked and were unlikely ever to wish to veil themselves, Islam took on a very different form. One of the great scholars of the period, Snukur Granji, observed in an essay written in 1906 that the Javanese render in a purely formal manner due homage to the institutions ordained of Allah, which are everywhere as sincerely received in theory as they are ill-observed in practice. Java, in short, was a place where Islam was amiably syncretic, more or less well-disposed to everyone, whether a Christian from Europe, a Hindu from the Malabar coast, or a Buddhist Chinese from Amoy, who happened by. Very much later, indeed at about the exact time of the Krakatoa eruption in the late 19th century, this all was to change. Orthodox Islam, its revival in part triggered by tragic events such as the Great Cataclysm, was utterly transformed in Java during the 19th century, with fundamentalism and militancy and profound hostility to non-Muslims its watchwords. But that was later. At the time of the building of early Batavia, the Dutch had little reason to be fearful of the Javanese as Muslims. They had other reasons to be uncertain, true, but it was not the thought of a fatwa or a jihad that had made most of them jumpy. They built their fortress Batavia for more mundane reasons, bowing to the kind of unspoken fears such as anyone camped in an unfamiliar jungle might experience, and which might prompt him to mount a picket, to light a bonfire, or be ready with a gun, or to construct a wall. At first, the Dutch created around their little town a series of high wooden palisades, but after 30 years of a growing insecurity, the Governor-General agreed to raise funds to enclose an area of about a mile square within a formidable lager of stone. In some places, this was simply provided by the massive outer walls of the dockside spice warehouses. Elsewhere, sappers built a 12-foot-high masonry structure with embrasures, barbicans, donjons, battlements, a moat and a sentry walk. Beyond it stretched the jungles, hot, dense, soggy and ever hostile, alive with animals, the tiger and the panther, the tapir and the one-horned rhino, black apes and giant rats, a range of giant pythons and venomous cobras, together with a gaudy wealth of cockatoos, parrots and birds of paradise. Inside the walls grew up the curiously compounded population of this quintessentially company town. Dutchmen were at first rather reluctant to come. Only the scum of the earth, complained Cohen, wanted to settle, and in the early years only a vanishingly small number of Dutch women appeared on the scene. In fact, there were so few females that Cohen was forced to appeal to Holland. Everyone knows that the male sex cannot exist without women. If your excellencies cannot get any honest married people, do not neglect to send underage young girls. Thus do we hope to do better than with older women. At first, only company servants from other Asian outposts of the VOC would deign to work in Batavia. Company employees, their slaves, for slavery, usually of men from faraway islands or from elsewhere in Asia, was permitted and was extraordinarily widespread in the early years of Dutch rule in the East. A motley garrison of soldiers, with troops from as far away as Japan and the Philippines brought to do guard duty under their bewildered Dutch officers, and, on occasion outnumbering everyone else, a very large number of Chinese.